I'm unashamedly and unabashedly a man of the South, because if I tried to deny it, if you know me for about 5 minutes, then there's no use to deny something like that, because it's so obviously true. I teach a course in this subject at the seminary, and I think sort of as introduction to what we're going to do together for the next four Sundays in a row beginning today. It might be helpful, it might even be important, to set the subject in some context. And so I want to do that. I want to be clear up front that I'm not interested, I have no reason to be interested, in making the Bible funny. Right? And I'm not interested in religious jokes. I have people who show up for the course sometimes, thinking that what I'm going to do is supply them with an armor, you know, sort of a treasury of those kind of jokes that preachers need to start out the sermon or to throw in midways when the congregation's about gone to sleep, you know, those kinds of things. And while I could do that, that's not the interest of my that's not the focus of my interest on this subject. The focus of my interest on this subject is the notion or the realization that I had some years ago that there is actually humor in the Bible, that the Bible is actually at points quite funny and intentionally so. The experience I had teaching undergraduates, now you have to bear in mind that when I taught at Carson Newman, a full teaching load consisted of nine sections a year. So typically you would teach five in the fall and four in the spring, or if you were eager, you know, if you wanted to stretch it out, you could do four and one in the summer, and all kinds of things like that. And typically, since Religion 101, Introduction to the Old Testament, was one of the gen ed course as required at the college, my job involved teaching Old Testament eight times a year, and then one, or sometimes seven times a year, if it worked out, and then one or two, something upper level. So I taught there for, and when I was younger, I needed money, so I taught in summer terms extra and did all this kind of stuff. So in 10 or 11 years at Carson Newman, I must have taught the Old Testament, Introduction to the Old Testament. Do the math. What is that? 80, 90, 120 times.
You can teach it without using any notes.
In fact, I did teach it without using by the end. One time, I was doing a text that we're going to look at today. It's the birth of my interest in the topic was in a text we're going to look at today. I was lecturing along to a class of, it was an honors class of freshmen, probably the 98th time or something I'd taught the course. And I was reading this text and expositing it and doing my theological thing, and I suddenly found something I had just read and talked about funny. I chuckled to myself. I stifled back, actually, just stopping and having a good laugh. Because I'd never laughed, this was new. Never happened to me before. I'd taught this text 98 times, and here in the 98th time, I made sort of a note to myself to get back to the office and I would think about this. And I stifled back the humor, the laughter, and went on with the lecture. Got back to the office, and I thought, okay, now what's happened here? And I decided there were one of probably three possibilities. One possibility was that I had gotten shell-shocked, you know, sort of, shell-shocked with the thing, sort of punch drunk. I had taught this text so many times, I was doing it a little bit on autopilot, I will admit. And I had found myself humorous, you know, which I do quite regularly. I amuse myself a lot. The second possibility was that I was having a cross-cultural experience, that the biblical author was telling what happened, and there was no humor in that from his perspective, but that from my perspective, as a then 20th century East Tennessean, second millennium, you know, ancient Near Eastern behavior was odd. And I had found that funny. That was a possibility. The third possibility, which was unheard of to me at the time, was that the Bible meant to be funny here. That this was a funny story. Right? I did what I always do, still do this in my practice. I have a drawer in which I have file folders that I'll never get all the way through, but I title them and start collecting things. These are potential research topics, right? Something I might teach a course on or write a book on or do an article on or something one day. I need to stop compiling those because I'll never get through the drawer that's there as it is. But maybe I'll start handing them out to students one day. Say, here. Anyway, I started one on humor in the Bible, and I collected some things over time. Did a little reading. As I noticed other passages in Scripture, I would write that down on a thing. Got to the seminary some years later, and it came my turn to teach, to represent the Bible area in the January term course. Just so you know, I hate January term courses. 3 weeks, you know, what do you do in 3 weeks? And so the dean said, well, what do you think about it? I said, well, you know, I've been interested for some time in the whole notion of humor in the Bible. I want, he said, humor in the Bible? Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 9 to 12. There you go. I said, okay, well, boy, I hope that the file folder wasn't thick enough at the time, and so I realized I was going to have to hit the library, which is what we scholars do when we don't know what we're talking about. So, I did, right?
That dean was not Israel Galindo.
No, and it wasn't Richard Vinson. Holbrooke. But anyway, Halbrooke. But anyway, I prepared the course, and I taught it in January, and I hoped that it would be enough material to spend 3 weeks on. In point of fact, now I teach a semester-long course in it and don't cover everything that I could. Because my discoveries were quite eye-opening. So it's important for us, to go along some of that discovery process I had. I discovered that humor is a serious topic of study for a lot of people. Psychologists, very interested in it. Sociologists, anthropologists, philosophers, political scientists, anyone who's interested in what it is to be a human being in terms of the way we behave and think. And there's a great long discussion that goes back all the way to Aristotle, anyway, in terms of what is humor, how does it function, what's it about, what is a sense of humor, how do we have one, and all of that kind of stuff. That discussion is fascinating. And if you take the course at the seminary, and we spend a week or two, I'm afraid, on that. I'll boil that down in this context to a sort of a working definition that I think is very important, because we all have our senses of humor and we all think know what we think is funny. But if you're going to talk about dealing with something with an ancient literature, for example, we're going to be making that jump across time and space and language, then we need some kind of working definition. And the working definition that I think most everyone would agree on is that the sense of humor, the comic experience, involves a recognition of incongruity when things just don't quite match up. Now, I often tell the story to illustrate this. It dates back a few years when all of our kids were still at home. And I am not a Luddite. I'm not afraid of technology, although I just am afraid of becoming a slave to it. So I have resisted everything for a little while anyway. I resisted cell phones for a few years. But we got them, and it turns out that we would have had to live a different kind of life than we do. Our children, by the time they were in junior high school, were in all these musical things, and there were rehearsals every night for somebody and all this kind of stuff. And I would have faculty meetings and what. And typically, it was not at all unusual on, say, a Tuesday or a Wednesday afternoon for one of us to call the other and say, you know what, I just remembered that, so, and you have a meeting and I have a thing and they've got to be at such and so at such and such a time, and what are we going to do for dinner? And I would, one of us would say, well, I'll tell you what, I'll brown and I'll put on the wall I'll hand off the baton, we'll do a tag, and you can finish and I'll go on to the... So it wasn't unusual for me to come home and start dinner, to have to leave to go preach somewhere or something before dinner time, but it had to be started. We do that sort of thing. We still do that. although under less pressure. Hallelujah. But anyway, in those cases, I didn't want to take time to change clothes five times in a day. So I would just have on what I have on, you know. And that we have this apron, the only one that's big enough. It's this great big one of the kind that goes around your neck and does the ding. And it's a Christmas apron. It's green and everything's got Santa Claus on the front of it, you know. And my children just love that. I mean, they love to come in from school and find me, you know, in my suit, basically, with this Santa Claus. I mean, August, it's not a year time of the year. It's the one that fits. You know, I don't care what. I'm not trying to, you know, perpetuate a theme or anything. I'm trying to keep from getting grease on my thigh. But they'd come in, and they just thought it was hilarious, the most hilarious thing that ever. Now, what happened in that moment for them was that they recognized the incongruity of here, you know, how many different roles was I fulfilling there, and in what kind of ways? I was dad, I was cook, I was professor about to leave, you know. So there's that sense of incongruity. Now, there are some things that, just from that basic definition, that we have to draw out, and there are warnings. One of the questions I've always had is, why is it that I was in my probably late 30s, with all of those degrees in Bible before I began to notice there was humor in the Bible, and nobody else. This has not been it's been a discussion among anthropologists and philosophers, but it has not been a discussion among biblical scholars until recently. There are a few others beside me who have gotten interested in it. Why might that be? What's going on here? And I think there are a couple of things we can draw out already from the definition of what humor is. First of all, this recognition of being, as respect to our finding it in the Bible, right? To begin with, we have all of these obstacles for us. The notion that we have the Bible in translation. Much of my work in the subject of humor on the Bible has to do with wordplay. And you can imagine how difficult it is to translate a pun in Hebrew from time to time into a corresponding pun in English. It's just, you can break your head trying, you know, and then eventually you just give up and do a footnote. This is a pun. Right? This is a play on words. Trust me. There's the whole problem of cultural things. I imagine that if Abraham were to have walked into my house, into the kitchen when I was, he wouldn't have known that there was anything incongruous about that, right? He may have thought that every father in America had an apron more or less like that, and that was how you dressed when you browned hamburger meat. It was just what you did. He wouldn't have known. Because there are, if there's going to be incongruity, what are we talking about incongruity with? We're talking about a cultural context sometimes. And we aren't in this cultural context. So we may have to make a little effort to put ourselves in that mindset so that we can see what is humorous. One of the huge difficulties, and I just don't know how to do this, is that humor, in its most native form, it's not a literary thing. I have great respect for the Mark Twains and so forth of the world who can do humor on the page. Because if you know the funniest, if you think about the funniest people you know, they're funny because of the way they are able to use voices or cadence in their speech, or how they can tell a joke. You know, the whole thing about the ability to tell a joke, right? And some people just don't have that. It depends on, you know, on what we hear or what we see. On the pages of text, I don't know how you quite do that timing and that intonation. It's compounded by the fact that in translation, in English, we at least have punctuation. You know, we can at least put a question mark or an exclamation point. But think about all of the freight that an exclamation point has to carry in our system. Wow! Exclamation point can be wow, or wow, or any range of things. Like in Hebrew, they didn't even have a period yet. They hadn't figured that idea out by the time the Bible was written. So there are all of these obstacles to dealing, to finding humor there. By the same token, I think it's important to recognize what is implied in the notion that humor involves the recognition of incongruity with respect to why the Bible might be interested in using it. And here is where I'm just dumbfounded by the fact that it has taken us so long to open up our eyes to this. Yes?
Would some of this be because it's supposed to be the Word of God?
That's number one. That's where I start. Listen, I get hate mail about the course I teach at seminary. I am not kidding. I get hate mail. I get email and so on and so forth. I always tell everyone that I keep those things. I print them out, and if it comes physically, I just put it. There's a left hand. If you sit down at my desk in my office, pull out the left hand drawer. There's a hanging file folder there, and right up front, it's one that says Wackos. If anything ever happens to me under unusual circumstances, somebody tell the FBI or the police ever to look in the Wacko file. I always handle them by the corner, you know, if it comes in the mail, and they can get fingerprints and everything. I've got it right there. This is the place to start. The other place is in my grade book. There is this letter F that goes by, and D that go by some names. That means, you know, foe, because it's a potential enemy of mine. You might look there too. And the reason I get the hate mail is because they think I'm making fun of the Bible. I have no interest. Why would I want to do that? I have no interest in doing that. I have no interest whatsoever in turning Holy Scripture into a comic book. On the other hand, a fundamental recognition in respect to this whole notion of incongruity is that the Bible is the story of God's relationship with His people. And there is the operative word. People are funny. Even God's people. Right? I had a junior high school principal who used to say that people have more fun than anybody. And that's the way it works. yeah. More fun than anybody. And so I wonder if we should be surprised that there are characters in the Bible who, like you and I, do some pretty incongruous things. Right? Now, it all boils down to, for me, and to the notion I'm watching the clock, I want us to be able to do the text all the way through. One of the fundamental notions of this notion that humor is, one of the fundamental results of the notion that humor is incongruity has to do with the fact that in order to recognize something as incongruous, we have to have a sense of what ought to be in order to make that recognition. And very important to me in my study of humor in the Bible, I'm very serious about that. I'm serious about humor. Because when you chuckle, when you find something humorous, it means that you've recognized that something is out of kilter here. And in order to make that recognition, you have to have a sense of what ought to be. Are you following me? So that I say that humor has a prophetic or a truth-telling character. It makes you aware that you've confronted a truth that underlies the incongruity you're looking at. We've all had, you know, we say, I had to laugh about it or else I would have cried. We all have experienced those situations where we're chuckling along and because my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, she was has a big part of my life and she was something else. A quite vain woman in all the positive senses, but not either. Just as down to earth as you could get, and she had a sense of humor that was rapier sharp. You'd have the kind of experience. By the time I was a teenager, I can remember several occasions where my grandparents lived at the bottom, right where you start up the mountain, I grew up in the mountains of northeast Alabama, right up. You start up the mountain from town to go out to where my parents live. And whenever I was in town, I would always stop in there before I headed, or stop in there as soon when I dropped off. But often when I was headed up the mountain, I'd stop and say hey to Granny and Papa. And I can remember several occasions when I would leave my grandparents' house and be halfway to the top of the mountain, chuckling about something my grandmother had said, and then stop chuckling and think and realize, hey, did she just say that I have? But she made me laugh about it, and she was my grandmother, right? And I was halfway home before I realized it worked. You know, I went and I would fix it, whatever it was, when she had gotten to me that way. Because I wasn't going to let, you know, I wasn't going to let that stand if my grandmother could make a joke out of me. Right? Nobody wants your grandmother to make a joke out of you, make you into a joke. I was going to fix the thing. Right? So there's a truth. And I encourage people, period, this is in general, whenever you laugh, it's a good time to stop and ask yourself, at least briefly, what truth did I just recognize? What truth, usually, about myself did I just acknowledge? Okay, so humor in the Bible is, I think, is there because the Bible is telling the story of real people, and real people are funny, and there's truth to be recognized that can be pointed out to us through a laugh that we might not be so willing to hear if it's told to us in prose, right? Especially in terms of characterization. You know as well as I do, I have just told you a little story about my grandmother. You'd never met her, but you're beginning to formulate an idea of what kind of person she was, right? We can often characterize someone. We do. When you ask someone about someone else that you don't know, they don't give you the CV. They don't say born in whenever and went to whatever. They say, well, let me tell you a story about him. One time we were, and that is how you convey the essence of who someone is. So the Bible is telling the story of God's people, right? Okay, here we go. What was the text? Now, Genesis 24. And if you have Bibles, you'll want to turn there. It is the longest chapter in the book of Genesis. 67 verses long. 67 verses long. Archie's going to distribute Bibles. You won't need them until we get down to that. I've got to summarize the first 60 something verses for you. And we'll read the last handful, okay? I contend this is a humorous account. And humor, in all contexts, the punchline is where? If you tell the punchline to begin with, don't bother to tell the joke, right? By the way, there aren't very many jokes in the Bible. You know, there aren't very many did you hear the one abouts. Yeah, it doesn't work that way. Chapter 24, here's the situation. Abraham, who received God's promise that he would be the ancestor of a great nation. And you know how this whole story unfolds. He and Sarah are old and they don't have any children, and the whole question of how am I going to be the ancestor of a great nation if I don't have one son, right? You got to start somewhere, and one son would be a good starting. And you know how all of that unfolds. Well, we're in the part of Abraham's life now where the son has been born, and he's grown up and survived that test with respect to the sacrifice and all of that kind of stuff. The Genesis 24 doesn't tell us this, but we know from the surrounding context that it the moment this takes place, Isaac is in fact 40 years old, right? Unmarried. Have no record that he even went to the prom in high school, right? And Abraham thinks he's dying. Now, he's not dying. The patriarchs are bad about this. They think they get old and they think, oh, I'm dying, you've got to be. And they live another 50 or 60 years and marry four or five more wives and have 10 or 11 more kids. But anyway, Abraham thinks he's dying. And he takes account of things and he recognizes that this business, this promise that he will become the ancestor of a great nation is in real danger, because although he has a son, this son is 40 years old, unmarried, and shows no interest. So he calls in a servant of his, maybe Eliezer, although it's not, he's not named, and he says, this is what I want you to do. I want you to promise me. I really would rather that Isaac didn't marry one of these Canaanite girls from around here, right? I'd really rather he married somebody from back home, right? So what I want you to do is I want you to go back where we came from, and I want you to promise me that you'll bring back a wife for Isaac. And the servant says, I can't make that promise, because I can't just go, you know, wheeling into town somewhere and pick some woman and bring her. You know, what if I can't find anybody willing to come? And Abraham says, I hadn't thought about that. Okay. And the servant says, well, I'll tell you what I will do. I promise to try. And Abraham says, well, okay, that's, if you'll give it a good, hard try, then that'll satisfy me. And so they do. He promised, swears an oath and everything. And so the servant loads up 10 camels worth of stuff. 10 camels worth of stuff, right? And heads out for Haran, which is in Syria. Both ancient and modern Syria on the map. Just as he's about to, you know, pull into town with his caravan, he thinks a minute and he says to himself, wait a minute. This is a walled city. We don't know quite how large it was in those days, because we don't know when those days were precisely. But we know it was a walled city most of the second millennium. So we can imagine, you know, that there will have been at tens, scores, if not, you know, 100 or so young women in the right bracket, right? And the servant thinks to himself, boy, I should have thought this through. I've gotten myself in a situation here. What am I going to do? Hold a contest? Have a drawing? How am I going to pick which one? And so he says, okay. And he prays to God. He says, now God, I need to be able to do this. And so, I tell you what, he says, let's let the young woman whom, when I ask her, I'm going to go to the well area, which made sense because that's where everybody gathered in the course of a day, especially the women. He says, I'm going to go there and I'm going to ask some young woman for a drink of water. And the young woman who then offers to water my camels, I will know that she's the one. And so he pulls into town and along comes Rebecca, right? And he says to her, may I have a drink of water? And she says, sure. And then she says, oh, and I tell you what, I'll water your camels for you. And he says, great. And the Bible says he sat there and watched her water the camels to see if it was going to come out. Now, this is one of those places where we've immediately run into this culture problem. It was by this time that I had started to get ready, you know, the giggle was building in me when I had the experience teaching. Let's analyze what's going on here. Let's use what we know. See, here's the deal. An ancient reader knew this immediately and would have envisioned all this. We've got to think a minute. We've got to be analytical. How much does a camel drink?
A week's worth.
In gallons, we're talking, you know, what, 30, 40 gallons of camel? What's involved in drawing water from an ancient well? Well, they had them dug below ground with a flight of steps. You know, they would cover it over. This was to keep preserve water. And so she will have carried the water in one of those, probably on her head or her shoulder, which holds how much, do you think?
5 gallons.
Better not be much more than 5 gallons. 10 gallons of water, and that's more than she could. So we've got 5 gallons. We've got, let's say, be conservative and say 30 gallons of camel times 10 camels. That's 300 gallons divided by 5. 60 trips. Down to draw water, up, pour it in the watering trough. And now, this is how it went. He said, could I have a sip to drink? And she said, yes. And I tell you what, I'll water your camel. We might not know what was involved. Did she know what was involved?
This is a woman who wanted to get out of Dodge.
Yeah. Yeah, well. Or, I mean, did he did not identify himself to her until after this. Right. He was a rank 100% stranger. Right?
Yeah, but he had 10 camels.
He did have 10 camels.
He's a rich stranger.
He did? Yeah.
He's a rich stranger.
Maybe. And she, this doesn't make me feel much better about, you know, I don't encourage Ellen to water the camels with rich strangers. Right?
One prophetic for having some humanity.
Well, what do we learn about Rebecca here? When she was generous, and more than that, she was a hard worker. And what's interesting is the text here introduces a theme about Rebecca that carries all the way through. It says she did this hurriedly. The King James and RSV says hurriedly. The Hebrew there, that's a pretty good translation. And if she's described as doing something hurriedly in this chapter one, she's described as doing it hurriedly about five or six times. Remember that, right? It may come back to bite her. So she hurriedly waters, and he sits there on the right. You know, how long is this going to take? Does he offer to help?
Just like a man.
She said, "Just like a man." I did this presentation not long ago, and there was a gentleman in the group who said he'd told the story that he'd been in the army in the Second World War in North Africa, and that he had seen an incident similar to this come up in an oasis area, and they were watering the crops, not the camels. They had an irrigation ditch situation where you drew water and poured it, and then it ran. And he said he saw this older Arab fella sitting in the shade of the palm tree, and there were 10 or so women of various ages busily drawing water and pouring it in the thing, and through the interpreter he discovered that this man's wives and daughters, right? And he was watching, supervising, and he said, "I made a motion to him as to suggest, you know, that there was some contrast," and that the old guy just laughed really big and continued to sit under the palm tree, right? So here we have the servant watching all it. Now, after she's watered all the camels, 60 trips up and down the thing, he asks her who she is. He does not identify himself to her. He gives her nose rings and ankle bracelets and unloads one camel's worth of goodies on her. And he says, "I actually need a place to stay." And she says, "Why don't you just come on back to my house?" Now, I know things have changed. This is one of those cross-cultural moments. But I begin to wonder if she's not also just a little bit naive. Because, well, I just think of Ellen and some dude wheeling up. And he shows up at my door after giving her a bunch of jewelry. And we're going to find out really quickly who he is and what he's up to, right? Well, he shows up at her house. Her dad's dead now, and she's living with her older brother. And he introduces himself fully. And this is one of the things that makes the text so long, and it's a technique of Hebrew storytelling. They say, "Who are you and what have you come for?" He recounts in great length everything that has happened. And the narrator recounts his recounting at great length. Now, if I were to have written the story today, I would say, "And he told them the whole story." Right? The Bible says, "And he said, and Abraham called me in, and he said, 'Would you go?' And I said, 'Well, I can't promise, I'll try.' And then he said, 'Swear,' and I swore. And so then I loaded up the 10 camel." And so if you have any question whether you understood the first part of the chapter or not, read the second part of the chapter, because it's going to tell you the whole story, start to finish, all over again, almost verbatim. Right? Right? So you'll get the whole thing, right? And he said, so we'll get. I'll imagine I've told you that whole story a second time, and he says, "So here I am, and God has clearly brought me here, and this is what I want to know. can I take her back to be my master Isaac's wife? And they say, in effect, well, sounds like you and God have this all worked out. What do we? He said, well, fine then, I'd like to leave tomorrow morning, bright and early. And they say, oh, whoa. This is the first we hear about this. We don't know you from that. You come driving up and this is our, you know, well, give us a little while to have a proper going away party, and we need at least 10 days to think this thing through and get used to it and tell her goodbye appropriately. It's only about 200 something miles south end, which doesn't sound like much to us, but in those days that's a world away. He said we may never see her again, and you're gonna wheeling in here one day and take her away. And they said let's see what she says. So they call her in and say, you know, this is the whole deal, and the fellow wants to leave first thing in the morning. Are you willing to go back with him tomorrow and be this guy's wife? And she says, remember, she does things hurriedly. She doesn't say, oh, give me some time to think about it. She doesn't say, I'd like to hear more. She doesn't say, do you have a photograph? You know, what she says is, sure. And so the text says they gave a little party, and the next morning he unloads all the camels. By the way, why the 10 camels? The wedding present. So he unloads all that stuff and for them, and loads all her stuff and her servants, and they head out. Right? Head back south. And now we come to the part of the story. Chapter 24. And now, I've given you all the hints you're going to need. Okay? Now Isaac, well, with a couple exceptions, had come from Be'er Lahai Roi and was settled in the Negev. That's the southern Judean desert. Isaac went out in the evening. Here's one bit I need to fill in. If you have your Bible open, and when you look at your Bible, mine says in the evening to walk. The King James has to meditate, I think. You'll probably have a note there. Mine has a little letter B. You look at the bottom and it says, meaning of Hebrew word is uncertain. Right. That's because it is uncertain. That's because it's what we call the hapax legomena. It's a word that appears in the Old Testament once. And if you have a word that appears once, there are some cognate languages that have a word very similar that seems probably to be etymologically related. In Assyrian, for example, Akkadian, it means to, let's see, how shall I put this? Answer the call of nature.
Right. The one out checking the stars.
Yeah. So, and now, am I saying that's what the Hebrew word means? I don't know. But if you want to list candidate possibilities, in my view, that's the best candidate. Because anything else is speculative. This one we at least have a cognate. Right? Licht and light. Right? We have a related language that has a word that seems to be etymologically related, and it means. Okay. You fill that in how you want. He got up and went out in the evening in the field to do something. You can almost do it. And he went out to do something in the field, and that almost covers it. Right? And looking up, he saw camels coming. And Rebekah looked up, and when she saw Isaac, and here's where this is the very phrase, this next one. She slipped, the RSV says, she slipped quickly from the camel. The Hebrew there has the word nafal, which means to fall. And hurriedly, here's our hurriedly word again. This is about the fourth time here. It's used of Rebekah. So get this, and I started just chuckling. Get the image, right? There, run to 10 camels. And she, right? And fell off the camel in a hurry. Because she had seen whatever it is she had seen. Right? Now, I want to say something about reading the Bible. If I could get the whole Christian world to do just this, I will have accomplished everything I need to have done in a life's worth of work. Slow down. Read the whole story. Give it time. Think about what's going on. Right? Picture it in your mind. Turn it over and over like you would a good meal. Don't and go on, because you're missing things. Read it a second time. Notice the repetitions, the allusions. Notice the rhythm. Notice the tone. Smell it. Touch it. Taste it. Okay? Because this is where I started, and I'm thinking to myself, why did she, kabloom. Right? Something, right, has gotten her attention. Positively or negatively. Now, here's where tone comes in. This is on a piece of paper. I'm going to read you the next little bit of the story three ways. I'm going to read it to you the preacher way. Yuck. Right? Then I'm going to read it to you two ways that suggest possibilities. Okay? She fell from the camel and she said to the servant, "Who's the man over there walking in the field to meet us?" And he said, "It is my master." Right? She either said, "Who is the man over there?" Woo! The one. Ha! Huh? Well, the one walking this way. And the servant said, "Yep. That's my master." In which case, she fell off the camel because
he was hot.
Whoa! Man! I have hit the jackpot! Right? Or she said, "Who is that man over there?" And the servant said, "Are you..." "That's my master." In which case, she fell off the camel because... Now, let's review what we know. She's probably about... 15. Yeah, she's probably about 15. And he's... 40. She's never been married. But he hasn't either. Right?
An older man.
I should say.
Probably with a long beard.
And maybe he had hair here and none here, you know? A little paunch. I don't know what. By the time you're 40, things start happening. And this is where I was laughing. I'm thinking now. And when I taught the class way back then and got chuckly, I thought, now what's going on here? What's happened here? What is she thinking? Are there any clues in the text? Well, we have so far abundant ones. She makes rapid decisions, right? You suppose she's thinking to herself, "Oh my goodness. Are you willing?" "Sure," I said. "You want to leave tomorrow morning?" "Sure," I said. Right? Water his camels, stinking on it. Is she thinking to herself, "What have I done?" Or is she thinking to herself, "Once again, God has blessed me, greatly for my industry and my willingness to take risks." I got to know. I want to know. Does the text have a clue? Are you ready? We haven't come to the end yet. So she took her veil and covered herself. Now, I don't know what that's about. I hadn't figured that out yet. She'd been riding along with the servant all this time without her veil on, and now she decides to put it on. I don't know what that means. And all the suggestions don't make any sense, so I don't know. Verse 66. And the servant told Isaac all the things he had done. Fine. Verse 67. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent. He took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. Last sentence in the chapter. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. You can go ahead. It's all right. That's exactly. Why was Isaac 40 years old and had never married?
He hadn't found his mother.
He didn't need to. No reason. Right? Now, review what we know about Sarah. You remember how she ran Ishmael off, and she was ferociously a defender of her dear darling Isaac, right? She had died in chapter 23. And in chapter 24, that's when Abraham decided that he better get Isaac a wife. Into his mother's... I don't quite know how to say it. You know, honeymoon and mama's... No. You know, and here's one of these times people will say, well, wasn't that the custom? No, it wasn't the custom. Right? This is truly, really and truly weird. Why? It answers everything, doesn't it? Why he hadn't sought a wife? Why his daddy had to do it for him? Listen, I may have to do a lot of things for my boys, but finding a girlfriend hadn't been one of them. Or boyfriend for my daughter, either one. It's been the other way around. You've been weeding them out. No. She may go. No, we don't need him. It hasn't been finding them, right? They've done quite a good job of that by themselves. The notion that one of my boys would be 40 years old and I'd have to... No. Not going to happen. All right. Let's ask this. How do you... If you don't know the rest of the story, what would you predict? Who's going to wear the robe in this family?
Yeah.
And do you know the rest of the story? Who does? She sure does. We note as Bible scholars that you have the Abraham cycle, as we call it, or the Abraham narrative, and you have the Jacob narrative, and there's no story in the Bible in which Isaac is the main character. He's always somebody's son or somebody's husband or somebody's daddy, but there's never a story about Isaac. Why? He seems to have been a wimp.
But there often needs to be a dominant person.
Well, there will be. But let's back up and put this in the context of the whole biblical story and why I think it's important. Why I think observing this is significant. And I'm going to get serious now. When you read the story of the patriarchs, Abraham, old, slow in understanding, Isaac. By the way, we oftentimes overlook the significance of the sacrifice of Isaac's story. You know, when Abraham takes him out and does this, and I'd have been a mama's boy too. That's enough right there, all by itself. To make a mama's boy out of you, right? And by the way, mama being a mama's boy ain't such a bad thing. I tell Ellen that if she finds a young fellow who's not at least a little bit of a mama's boy, she needs to run, because you're supposed to be a mama's boy to a degree. Isaac was a little, you know, too enthusiastic about that, but I can imagine that after that sacrifice thing, that if Abraham had said, Isaac, I got the weekend off. I think you want to go fishing? I can imagine that Isaac would say, is Mama going with us? Can't you? I mean, I'm not going to hell for him by myself. Huh? Now, and Jacob, by the way, Isaac's sons, Jacob and Esau, what's Jacob's very name, you know, means cheat. So you've got this old guy, this mama's boy, and this cheat are the patriarchs of Israel. Cheat, yeah. And his name means to cheat, to connive, to outwit, to outfox. What does that say? My students will oftentimes, and other people, oftentimes ask, as we make our way through the Old Testament, and we find out that David's such a scoundrel, and so on and so on. You know, everybody you find in the Bible, there's something wrong with them. And they want to know why God couldn't pick somebody who wasn't going to screw up that way. Right? And I have to remind them that because the choice is don't give God a very good option. Right? From our perspective, we often look back on the Bible with this sort of pietistic notion. Why, you know, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And we assume, well, that Abraham, you know, he was a saint. Right? And Isaac, why he was Abraham's son. And Jacob, his name became Israel. And these people, they behaved in ways we couldn't possibly. They were giants of the faith. We don't have any chance of being... No. The Bible depicts for us people who are as flawed and silly, humorous, as you and I. And the point is that God uses even a mama's boy like this for his purpose. We are without excuse. I can't say, oh, but I'm not quite the caliber of Paul or Peter or James or John. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. It's not a question of your ability. It's a question of your availability. It's a question of what God can do through you. So, you're without excuse. Another thing, by the way, I'm supposed to, I'm singing in choir today, so I'm going to have to go. Another thing to point out, though, is that the Bible becomes a much more human, a much more accessible book when we read it this way. Right? It's not about back then and a culture that we don't, that's foreign to us and people who are holier and all that kind of stuff. It's about people. We know what mama's boys are. We know these dynamics because the mode of transportation may have changed. Right? But the people on the camel and the people in the sports car haven't changed that much. I have 5 minutes for questions. Anybody have a question?